This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. One of the most iconic and influential institutions in Chicago is the historic Johnson Publishing Company.
Dear Ebony, I would like to thank you personally for your article, Mothers and Daughters.
You know, the home of Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, pillars of Black media in the 20th century.
Ebony, for your life and your times, for people just like you.
Around the time Johnson Publishing Company shut their doors on Michigan Avenue, another Chicago icon, Theaster Gates, got a phone call. And it was from none other than Linda Johnson Rice, the daughter of John and Eunice Johnson, who founded the company.
And she asked me if I was willing to be the kind of caretaker of the things within that building, excluding the photographs. So the library, the furniture. And she said, essentially, whatever you're able to retain and retrieve, exhume from the building is yours. And so I've been living with these objects for the last decade now.
The Esther has now turned those objects into a new exhibit that's opening tomorrow. It's called When Clouds Roll Away, Reflection and Restoration from the Johnson Archive.
When Clouds Roll Away is an acknowledgement that some time has passed and that in it, so much more might be revealed. And so the premise of the exhibition is to reveal the important treasures of this insurmountable Black archive that is native to Chicago.
Theaster Gates is one of Chicago's most brilliant minds and prolific artists. He's a performer, a professor at the University of Chicago, and a steward of many important and iconic Chicago archives. A lot of his work focuses on urban planning and preservation, work that, quote unquote, redeems spaces that have been left behind, according to his website. And this new exhibit, When Clouds Roll Away, is looking to do that once again. For one, by repurposing artifacts from Johnson Publishing Company, but also by the location of the exhibit, the Stony Island Trust and Savings Bank. Theaster actually acquired this space, which at one point was one of those left-behind spaces. It used to be a bank during the Prohibition era, and it was crumbling when Theaster Gates acquired it from the city of Chicago for one single dollar. For more than a decade, he's been turning it into a Black archive and a third space, as he'll talk about in a minute. Today, I talked to Theaster about his efforts to preserve these kinds of spaces and artifacts, including the ones in this new exhibit. Theaster Gates, welcome to The Rundown.
It's so great to be here. Thank you so much.
Tell me about the title, specifically the When Clouds Roll Away component. Where does that come from?
It feels a bit Missionary Baptist Church to me, that when the clouds are gathered, it's a sign of forewarning or danger or discomfort, nature and discomfort. When they roll away, it represents kind of like the end of passing hardship. And I think for me, at least, with my friendship with Linda Johnson Rice and my concern about Black objects, when the company was transitioning, I felt like there was a big cloud over me and there was a big cloud over Johnson Publishing.
How so?
You know, there's part of me that feels like I wish the city would have done more to save the building and resuscitate the organization. That I have strong opinions about the future of that site and what its fate was, from being sold to Columbia College to being sold to micro apartment makers. And so I think that that cloud that loomed over me, it was a period of kind of real darkness for me. Now, a lot of the furniture has been restored. We've taken sections of the carpet that was there, sections of the wallpaper, some of the images, and we've tried to kind of make a survey of the Johnson Publishing Company's building as a work of art.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
The Johnson Publishing Company is most known for, I'll say it's most known to me as a Black millennial for two of its publications, Jet Magazine and Ebony Magazine. Growing up in the 90s, I didn't realize that these two publications were from the same publisher. One was weekly, one was monthly. They were different sizes. They felt different. But getting into your work, I've learned from you and your archiving and your canon of work around the archive that they were actually in conversation with each other.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. First, it's important to articulate that they were both based on popular Americana periodicals. So Ebony was based on Life magazine and Jet was based on Reader's Digest. Mm-hmm. So Ebony had the burden of presenting long form writing, pretty sophisticated advertising, critical reflections on Black life, and also the kind of, it was doing the work of early networking and connecting via the periodical. So it was saying, you know, our National Society of Black Dentists, we're getting together. The ladies of Alpha Kappa Alpha, here's our mission. And they were connecting Black people via their periodical. It's hard to imagine life without the internet, but they were the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
And then I think Jet Magazine was much more like the journal for everyday living. Mm. It told you what times and on what stations Black television was happening. It told you what the top 10, the top 20, top 100 hits were by Blacks. Mm-hmm. You might find out a little bit of gossip and you got your beauty of the week. And so it was also kind of like celebrating the ways that Black folks show up and then putting that dignity and that sexiness in that like Friday after work. It was putting that on the main stage and in a way teaching us how to be more dignified, more sexy, more respectable, what makeups to use. It was aiding the cultivation of middle class values in the Black American imagination. Mm-hmm. So that if, you know, people talk about this with the Defender, if you were newly coming up from Mississippi and you had Mississippi ways of dressing and behaving, when you got to the big city, there needed to be someone that could offer a little bit of Black reform. Mm-hmm. And I think Ebony and Jet both, they were clearly articulating ways of being Black and showing and promoting who was being Black well, that might emulate that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have spent over a decade with these archives, as you said.
The library's behind me being cataloged.
Oh, fact. Wow. Hey, library.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Let's continue with this strand of what it means and what it looks like to be Black and how that was portrayed back then. I heard you in an interview talking about the fact that when Black people talk about ourselves with pride and we present representations of ourselves in books, magazines, we focus on what we do best. A lot of the time, we focus on the most talented artists, most notable activists. But I heard you say as your work has evolved, you've started to think more about the everyday Black people living life. It reminds me of the photography of Cecil McDonald Jr., right? Capturing, you know, a girl dancing in the hallway at home, things like that. And as a person who is archiving, who is contemplating large amounts of work around Black life, tell me about the importance of approaching your work that way.
Yeah. When people think about the value of the archive, they're like, oh, there are these candid shots of James Brown and Aretha Franklin and, you know, kind of the who's who of culture. Yeah. And that's true. But by and large, you had amazing photographic journalists who were going all over the country and in sometimes other parts of the world, interviewing everyday people, talking to the school teacher about what she thinks about Black boys in education, you know, talking to the orthodontist about like, what's the future of medicine, you know? And I decided that I would focus my energy on the Black female kind of every day, or the Black woman as the Black Madonna. And the more common, the more unknown, the more Madonna-like she is, you know? And so I think that there is a lot of notable stuff behind me, but by demonstrating that 90% of the work that Johnson Publishing did was about everyday people, it means that it was about people just like me on 68th and Stony Island, on 69th and Dorchester, on 70th and Loomis, you know, that it was about Black life. And then that was punctuated with, you know, Diana Ross and the Jackson Five, you know.
Yeah. I mean, that's reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's us. You know, like
yeah.
One day I'm hanging out with, you know, folk on the block, and the next day I'm somewhere else hanging out with other folk on another block.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. The exhibition opens this Thursday. It'll be open until March of next year. As you mentioned, you got all these archives. They're right here behind you. You spent so much time with them. And still with this exhibition, we're going to see pieces that are newly restored, right? It's the most comprehensive celebration of the archive yet. If you could just take your mind back to first coming upon this collection, those days, you feeling maybe overwhelmed, feeling excited, and just kind of talk me through a narrative arc maybe of the story so far, your story with Johnson Publishing Company. It's a big question, but how would you do that?
I can do this. At the time that I was crafting the acquisition of the bank, the Arts Bank from the city of Chicago, I was trying to figure out, you know, what would I fill it with? You know, if I got the building, would the building be a place for just a social hang? Would it be kind of artist in residence? Would it be a venue of sorts? And in a way, once we got acquisition of the building, my meeting Linda Johnson Rice and her making the offering of her library, those things dovetailed. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the Arts Bank is deeply connected to the library of Johnson Publishing Company.
Ah.
So much so that we built the hearth of the building around the library.
Wow.
And so the early days was this amazing woman who carried this legacy was trusting this young artist, you know, younger artist, with her library. And I made good on the library. 2 years in, the building opened, the library was in place. By 2013, things were looking pretty good. And the city was coming, the Arts Bank was starting to be recognized as an important Black space. At that point, Linda needed to decide what to do with the rest of the things that were coming out of the building. And she came back to me, and that felt like trust. That Linda, let's say the Black business community, a kind of an important family in the city, you know, all those things that might seem socially political, that Linda Johnson Rice was trusting an artist with her family's legacy. Mm-hmm. And I think when that happened at about 2013, 2014, it's when I realized the work that I was doing was not just the kind of rescue and redemption. It was actually I was building the foundation for a platform for Black archivists and Black collecting, and building a kind of third space where if on the South Side or the West Side, you expect to see some things on the block, you don't expect to see a Black archive.
Mm.
But could it be a necessary part of the architectural image of our city that every block should have an archive of what's been going on in that neighborhood? And so I think that in essence, the bank is trying to do this demonstrative work of setting an example for the objects that come in, how there's a kind of slow, we haven't been able to do this quickly. You know, it took us 6 years to digitize Frankie Knuckles albums. Mm-hmm. We're just at the edge of cataloging all of Johnson Publishing, but it's like, it's given Rebuild a purpose that is so sophisticated, and we'll do that work, you know, wherever we are.
The Astor Gates, thank you.
Thank you so much.
When Clouds Roll Away is open September 12th through March 16th at the Stony Island Arts Bank, which is at 68th and Stony Island Avenue. You can find more information at rebuild-foundation.org. And that's it for today. Justin Bull and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve is our editor and executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you on Friday.